that when you have ICE agents who are police on steroids, living in community, plaguing community, claiming our community is under siege, black people are going to catch the brunt of it. And that's what's happening with Keith Porter. One, if there's a silver lining, it's the solidarity. And so we're really, really grateful that black community and brown community, as well as visionary and progressive and courageous white allies and allies of color, have stepped up. And we've all said ICE out of LA and ICE out of everywhere, as well as an end to policing that steals the lives of our people.
I want to thank you for being with us, Professor Malina Abdullah, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, teaches Pan-African Studies at California State University, Los Angeles. And thank you so much to Janae Tyler, joining us from Compton, California, cousin of Keith Porter Jr., killed by an off-duty ICE agent on New Year's Eve with his ICE weapon. As Iran continues its bloody crackdown, President Trump announces a 25% tariff on countries doing business with Iran. We'll speak with Johns Hopkins professor Vali Nasser, author of Iran's Grand Strategy. He says this time is different for Iran. Stay with us.
I see somebody marching. Street, yeah. I see somebody marching. They're marching down the street. Oh, yes, they are. This time we stop and pray. We pray.
Streets, performed by Zeeshan B in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. President Trump says the United States will now impose a 25% tariff on countries that do business with Iran. The move would mean higher prices for U.S. companies that import products from China, India, Russia, Turkey, and Iraq. Trump made the announcement Monday on social media, where he also wrote, quote, "We're screwed," unquote, if the U.S. Supreme Court rules against the tariffs in a decision expected this week. Iran has said it's ready for war or dialogue after Trump said the U.S. is considering very strong options to intervene if Iran's security forces kill anti-government protesters in an ongoing crackdown. The Norway-based group Iran Human Rights says at least 648 people have been killed since broke out in late December, and more than 10,000 people, it's believed, have been arrested. An Iranian official also reported today the number of dead could be as high as 2,000. United Nations Human Rights Chief Volker Turk said in a statement read by a spokesperson today he was horrified by the mounting violence.
We are horrified by the mounting violence directed by security forces at protesters across Iran, as reports indicate hundreds have been killed and thousands arrested. The killing of peaceful demonstrators must stop. The labeling of protesters as terrorists to justify violence against them is unacceptable. We urge the Iranian authorities to halt immediately all forms of violence and repression against peaceful protesters and to restore full access to the internet and telecommunications services.
That's Jeremy Lawrence, spokesperson for the United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. For more, we're joined by Vali Nasser, professor of international affairs and Middle East studies at Johns Hopkins SAIS, that's School of Advanced International Studies. His news piece for Project Syndicate is headlined, Why This Time is Different for Iran, author of several books, including Iran's Grand Strategy, A Political History. He's joining us from Paris, France. Professor Nasser, thanks so much for being with us. Can you talk about what's happening now on the ground, what the anti-government protesters are calling for, and President Trump threatening to militarily intervene in Iran?
Well, these the protests in Iran started on December 28th in reaction to a drop in the currency and the dire economic situation in Iran. They have seen since expanded into much more anti-government, anti-regime protests demanding an end to the Islamic Republic. They have spread across the country. But we don't know what the status is exactly, because the government has imposed a news blackout or a blackout on the country. No internet, no communication with the outside. A lot of international flights in and out of the country have been canceled. So we don't know what is actually happening. And also yesterday, the government brought crowds of its own to denounce the violence of the that they claim the violence of the protesters. But what we know is that the situation in Iran is very precarious, that the government is clamping down very brutally, that the protesters are still demanding major changes, including some demanding the end to the Islamic Republic altogether, and the country is in a state of siege.
And Professor, we've heard about the toll in terms of the killings of the protesters, but the government is also claiming, and the Institute for the Study of War seems to have been backing the claims, that there have been at least 114 security force members killed. So how peaceful are some of these protests?
Well, the protests have increasingly grown more violent. First of all, even in major urban areas, there's a lot of angry people, and there have been clashes, and there have been setting off fires. American newspapers, New York Times, etc., did report that mosques, a number of government buildings, the state television in the city of Isfahan were set ablaze. So these are not crowds that are in all occasions carrying placards and denouncing the government. And then also in some of the provinces, particularly in the western Iran, there's also a proliferation of guns. There have been ethnic violence there in the past. So there is a number of people who have been killed are members of the security forces, and the government actually held a funeral for them today based on some reports coming out of Iran. But the majority of those who've been killed, the overwhelming majority of those who've been killed are the protesters. And the very fact that about 100 security people have been killed tells you about how ferocious and intense these protests have become, and how angry the population is, and why exactly this is such a major challenge to the hold of the Islamic Republic over Iran.
And can you talk about the economic situation in Iran and the impact that the U.S. sanctions, especially in the Trump period, have had on Iran?
Well, the Islamic Republic has faced anger from its population for varieties of things, for its authoritarian behavior, for imposing hijab and other religious rules on the population. The population as a whole is not happy with its government, but their anger has been intensified over the past 5-6 years since President Trump imposed maximum pressure sanctions, because it has led to major scarcities in Iran's economy. The currency has depreciated, the inflation has spiked. Just over the past year, between December 24th and December 2025, the currency lost about 84% of its value, and inflation on food products went up by about 72%. And that is squeezing the middle class. It's robbing people of their purchasing power. It's putting enormous amount of pressure on the population, particularly the poor members of the population, lower middle class, lower class. And economic hardship has aggravated the tensions that already existed towards the Islamic Republic. And we saw 2-3 years ago that this already was a factor when enforcement of hijab and the killing of a young woman for not wearing hijab properly exploded in the form of a national protest around the hijab issue, and it became something bigger. And again, this year we saw that the bazaar in Iran, the merchants protesting the collapse of the currency on December 20th, has metamorphosed into something much bigger. So as much as the Iranian government has tried to brush off the sanctions and persist in its nuclear position on its nuclear program and confrontation with the U.S., it's very clear that its population is becoming more exhausted, more angry, and is demanding change. And as it gets crushed between its own government's policies and U.S. pressure, it is showing signs of enormous amount of restlessness.
Before we go, Professor Nasser, if you could give us a little history lesson, if you see U.S. Trump saying he's supporting the protesters, so could militarily intervene, what U.S. intervention is met, like in 1953, in the form of grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, Kermit Roosevelt, who came into Iran to overthrow the democratically elected leader Mohammad Mossadegh, which he succeeded in doing. Then the Shah rose to power, and we see what we see coming out of that. And now the Shah's son being there, saying that, Reza Pahlavi, he is encouraging these protests and the possibility of him being brought back in.
Well, I don't think any leader from outside of Iran could be brought back in without a full-scale U.S. invasion of Iran and having U.S. troops sitting in Tehran to dictate who would be ruler. That was the scenario in Kabul and in Baghdad after when the U.S. invaded those countries. So I think the Shah's son, the former crown prince of Iran, has ability to rally the crowds or call on them to do things and has a certain support. But his ability to actually take over the government in Iran is absent. In 1953, the U.S. supported a coup that was led by Iran's own military. So there was a military on the ground, there were people on the ground, and the U.S. could support them to change the government. The U.S. does not have that capability in Iran right now. It doesn't even have an embassy. It has no relationship with any element of power in Iran. Bureaucracy, people in the political circle, Iran's military, Revolutionary Guards. The United States has no relations with them. So either it can wage full-scale war on Iran, which President Trump does not seem to be eager to do, or it can hope to squeeze Iran economically in order to create political unrest in Iran. So I think the model that is more apt to Iran, for Iran is something like what happened in Libya or Syria after the Arab Spring. In other words, a massive popular uprising that eventually could overwhelm the state and its security forces. But that's actually a recipe for chaos and civil war in Iran. It's not a recipe for a neat and clean regime change. So U.S. intervention right now looks very, very different. U.S. intervention is in the form of trying to create space for the protesters to continue to agitate against the government and then make the life of the Iranian people miserable so that more of them would join the protests.
Professor Vali Nasser, we thank you for being with us. Professor of International Affairs, Middle East Studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, SAIS, his new piece for Project Syndicate, Why This Time is Different for Iran. Next up is Trump Threatens Iran, Venezuela, Mexico, Greenland, and more. We speak with the renowned historian Alfred McCoy. His new book, Cold War on Five Continents, A Global History of Empire and Espionage. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As President Trump threatens Iran, Venezuela, Mexico, Greenland, and more, we spend the rest of the hour with the renowned historian Alfred McCoy. His new book, Cold War and Five Continents, A Global History of Empire and Espionage, and his recent article, Ending the American Dream by 2029. McCoy is a history professor at University of Wisconsin-Madison. We welcome you back to Democracy Now! In your book, you describe the 1953 coup in Iran as an act whose consequences were measured across decades, leading directly to the 1979 revolution. What are your thoughts on witnessing this escalating Trump threats against Iran, saying the U.S. may possibly intervene militarily there? Professor McCoy.
Thank you, Amy. The United States is an empire in decline. And if you look back over the past 100 years, the lessons of history are pretty clear. Declining empires suffer from two things. One, they suffer from micromilitarism abroad. They send troops abroad. They, in their flailing decline, thinking that some form of military intervention will recapture the global power that is slipping away from their hands. And then domestically, the other thing they suffer from, every single declining empire over the past 100 years, the Soviet Empire, British Empire, the Spanish, all the rest, they suffer from coups. And of course, we had our coup on January 6, 2001. So as American politics become increasingly contorted and irrational, I think the thing to do is to realize that we are an empire in decline and we are writhing in this kind of irrationality, particularly in the international realm, and it will continue for another decade or two until the power, American power, finally slips away.
And Professor McCoy, in terms of this declining empire, the Trump administration, President Trump has said he wants to increase military spending by 50% from $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion. How does this fit into the flailing of a declining empire, as you mentioned, and also this attempt to reassert control over the Western Hemisphere, to create essentially a fortress of the Western Hemisphere against the rest of the world, the likelihood of that succeeding?
Good question, Juan. First of all, the United States has been for over a century now dominant in the Western Hemisphere, or at least North America. And even with reduced global influence, the United States does have a capacity to exercise military force in the hemisphere. Whether that will produce good relations with our Latin American neighbors is highly questionable. But to turn to your question about this retreat from the world into the Western Hemisphere, that's effectively a near disastrous decision. Right now, we are in a new Cold War, a Cold War between Moscow, Beijing, and Washington. And the object of the new Cold War, just as it was for the old Cold War, is dominance, control over the vast Eurasian landmass. The way the United States won the Cold War, and we did win it, hands down, was that we encircled the vast Eurasian continent with an iron curtain, and we defended that iron curtain by rings of steel, naval armadas, aircraft, and above all, military alliances, the NATO alliances on the western end of Eurasia, and five bilateral military alliances with Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Philippines, and Australia on the eastern edge of Eurasia. And Washington simply sat back with the Sino-Soviet bloc contained behind what was called the Iron Curtain and waited for a blunder. And the Soviet Union, like many declining empires, engaged in this micromilitarism. It invaded and occupied Afghanistan in 1979, and by the time the Red Army withdrew 10 years later, bloody and battered, it was incapable and unwilling to intervene when Eastern Europe, the satellite nations, broke away and the Soviet republics, the Soviet Union broke apart, and that was the end of the Soviet Union and that was the end of the Cold War. So clearly, maintaining a position in Eurasia, particularly Western Europe, is critical to U.S. geopolitical position in this new Cold War. And Trump's retreat from Europe, his damaging of NATO, threatening Greenland, and if that happens, the Prime Minister of Denmark, a foundation member of NATO, has said that that's pretty much the end of NATO. So in many ways, Trump is damaging the U.S. position in Western Europe. And that constitutes almost a unilateral surrender in geopolitical terms in the midst of this new Cold War. So the retreat to the Western Hemisphere simply makes no sense. And the implications of this for the world are quite considerable, because both Russia and China are expanding their dominance over this vast Eurasian landmass. And that threatens the stability of the entire international system of law, trade, and diplomacy.
Well, you mentioned Russia and China in your recent piece, Ending the American Dream by 2029. You talk about China's electric vehicle production, which already is 70% of the global total, how that could make the U.S. auto industry, which has was for most of the post-World War II period the mainstay of the American economy, almost obsolete. Could you talk about the significance of that?
Sure. Right now, well, first of all, every major empire over the last 500 years has been synonymous with conquering or developing a new form of energy. For the Spanish, it was slavery, maximizing the energy output of the human body through cruel plantation slavery. For the British, it was the coal-fired revolution in steam power. For the United States, it was oil power. And we are now in the midst of a green energy revolution, switching to alternative energy, solar and wind power, particularly solar. And China is absolutely dominant in every aspect of this green energy revolution. And so since imperial power, global hegemony, is synonymous with energy innovation, China's dominance in this sector is going to be a key factor in its rising global hegemony, displacing the United States as the world's preeminent power. China already dominates the production of solar panels and solar panel components, and they're now turning that into this very important consumer durable, automobiles. And China's production of automobiles is extraordinary. They can produce a quick-charging, long-range electrical vehicle and sell it for $9,000. You can't get a secondhand Honda for $9,000 in the United States anymore. That's an extraordinary price. And they have a fleet of ships that are custom built, and their factories are robotic factories, all robotic factories, barely touched by a human hand, are cranking out cars literally by the millions. They are heading for the ports where specifically constructed ships are crossing to world markets. So they're building robotic plants around the world. China is capturing the global auto market, and this is the cutting edge of Chinese global power and energy innovation. So the United States is, in fact, retreating from the world economy and the world in two realms. One, a misuse of our military power and a gross miscalculation in terms of energy policy. And the two together, I believe, will serve as kind of accelerants for a U.S. decline in the global arena.
I mean, it's very interesting. A federal court in the United States has just ruled that President Trump cannot single-handedly stop offshore wind farms off the coast of the United States as he tries to completely move away from renewables and back to oil, which brings us to Venezuela, where after he had the Venezuelan president and his wife abducted in the news conference, he repeated dozens of times in his reasoning, he talked about oil. Now, I wanted to go to Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum on Monday, speaking with President Trump after he threatened U.S. military intervention, he said, to combat drug cartels in Mexico.
President Donald Trump and I talked about the joint work done in security. There are important results from the joint collaboration. For example, the fentanyl crossings have reduced by 50% in Mexico and the U.S. How's that measured? By the fentanyl seizures they do on the other side of the border. So CBP, which is a U.S. agency, makes public the amount of fentanyl seized on the other side of the border, and it has reduced by 50% in a year.
So if you could talk about back to Latin America, when it comes to Mexico, when it comes to Cuba, clearly setting his sights on Cuba, some say carrying out Marco Rubio, the Cuban-American Secretary of State's wishes that Venezuela is even a route to take down the Cuban government, now forbidding Venezuela from selling any oil to Cuba, which could very well further destabilize it. Talk about what's happening there.
Okay. If you look at last November, the Trump administration released what's called the National Security Strategy, the NSS document. And in this, Trump is very clear that the U.S. is going to reorient its military forces from a global position, essentially pull out of Europe, abandon the U.S. position on the vast Eurasian landmass, and relocate its forces into Latin America, and achieve absolute dominance over Latin America. The U.S. still has formidable military power, tremendous economic resources, and when we concentrate that on the southern border, on our southern neighbors, we can be, as we have been since the 1890s, absolutely dominant in the Caribbean, okay, and you know, from 1898 until really 1933, the United States exercised gunboat diplomacy in the Caribbean. Theodore Roosevelt sent the Navy to block Colombian forces and force the secession of Panama and its creation as independent states so we could build the canal. The U.S. forces shuttled in and out of the Caribbean for the next 30 years. It wasn't until the Franklin Roosevelt administration announced a good neighbor policy that we stopped that. But that's the Trump policy. We're returning to this gunboat diplomacy and this intervention. And frankly, we have sufficient power to do that. That will, of course, just as it did the last time, produce an enormous nationalist, anti-imperialist reaction in Latin America and undercut our serious long-term and diplomatic relationships with our Latin American neighbors. And China is already the dominant economic trade partner in much of Latin America. And I think over the long term, that will arouse hostility, increase China's presence, and increase diplomatic ties between China and Latin America. So it'll be short-term dominance and control for a long-term loss of influence and power.
We only have about 30 seconds, but the constant use of the United States, the war on drugs as a means to impose its will on Latin America?
Yeah, the war on drugs since President Nixon declared it back in 1972 has been a monumental failure. It's a very simple law of supply and demand. You attack supply, whether you're sinking drug boats in the Caribbean or you're trying to fumigate, defoliate crops in the hills. So when you attack supply, all you do is you reduce supply, you raise price, and that's incentive for growers to produce more drugs. And the logic of that has produced a tenfold increase in the supply of illicit narcotics since the drug war began over 50 years ago. So it's what I call the stimulus of prohibition.
Alfred McCoy, we're going to have to leave it there, but I'm going to encourage people to read your article and your new book. History professor, University of Wisconsin-Madison, his first book, Politics of Heroin, CIA Complicity in Global Drug Trade. His new book is Cold War on Five Continents. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
This is Max Markle, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1. Burnaby, the Chablis.
Hey, are you okay? It's okay not to be okay. That's why Kids Help Phone is available 24/7, 365 days a year, across Canada. So you don't have to deal with your feelings alone. You can text with a trained volunteer crisis responder or call a professional counselor. Whatever works best for you. You can also connect with Kids Help Phone through trained interpreters in over 100 languages, and it's always free. Visit kidshelpphone.ca for more info and give your feelings a place to go.
The Slate Family